So we're talking about physical cravings. One of the things I told you that I was going to show you is where step one is. Physical craving is one of three parts of step one. We've got the physical craving, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. Physical craving goes from the doctor's opinion up to the top of page 23. So that's what our goal here is, and we're running a little bit behind because we got started late, but that's what we're going to do. We've already talked about the doctor's opinion. One of the things I like to do with newcomers is with what I call the Bill Wilson exercise. Part of the goal in my sobriety is to identify with the founders. And I've done it for both Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, but it's a lot easier to identify with Bill Wilson from the way his story is laid out. So what I do is I take my big book, I take two different color highlighters. The first highlighter I take, but I don't care what the color is, and I go and I read Bill's story from page 1 to page 8, the first half of his story. And I highlight anywhere that I identify with Bill Wilson, how I thought like Bill Wilson, how I felt like Bill Wilson, how I drank like Bill Wilson. Anything that I can identify with, I highlight in one color. Then I put that marker away. Page 8, Bill Wilson got sober. He talked about his sobriety and what he did. So I highlight from page 8 to page 16 anything that Bill Wilson did that I am not willing to do. Why? Because if there's anything that he did that I'm not willing to do, that's what's going to kill me. And I need to know that. And if I find anything in there, I bring it to a sponsor. We sit down, we talk about it, and he helps me through it. All right? So if you've never tried it, give it a shot. You know, if you've done it with Bill Wilson's story, try it with Dr. Bob's. It's kind of interesting to go through and see. And I do it every time I go through the work. And I'm not one of these people that did it once and never do it again. I'm one of those crazies that go in for annual or semi-annual house cleaning, you know. And so at least every 6 months, because I'm not the same person. The person that got sober 18 years ago is not the person sitting at this table, thank God. You know, you change, you grow, you're a different person. You can identify with different things the longer you're sober. When I was 19, when I got sober, I could not have identified with going to war until I went to war, you know. And I'm reading the big book as I'm descending into the combat zone during the Gulf War. It changed my life. I had a higher power. You know, I turned my will and life over. I identify with going to war now. Different things over different experiences the longer you're sober. So I highly recommend that. So that's the Bill Wilson exercise. Now, Chris is going to take you through some of the identification stuff from Bill's story, and then I'm going to jump into the construction references, which is going to be kind of interesting for a lot of you that don't know. We're going to need those as we get later on. Also, during the break, before I hand it over to Chris, several people came up to me and talked to me about drug addiction versus alcoholism. Here's the deal. It doesn't matter to me what your truth is. I don't care if you're just an alcoholic or if you're an alcoholic and an addict. You know, if you got a weed problem, if you got a sex problem, if you got a gambling problem. You know, I 12-stepped a guy last week. In the middle of 12-stepping this guy, I'm talking to him, and he's not answering the questions right. I can tell he's hesitating before he answers every one of his questions. And I said, you're not alcoholic, are you? You don't really drink to make that, you know, don't have the problem with craving and the mental obsession. And he says, no. I said, well, when do you drink? And he says, I drink to make the pain go away after I act out sexually. He was a sex addict. Didn't matter to me. You know, I believe the way the steps were originally written, the original 12-step read, we carry this message to others, comma, especially alcoholics. I took him up to page 30. I let him self-diagnose himself. He came up with the fact that, hey, my real problem is I'm a sex addict and I smoke too much dope. And so he's now off dealing with that stuff. He still writes the same 12 steps. He's writing inventory and he's doing the work that it takes. The important thing about your differences, for whatever your truth is when we get to step 12. I don't care what your truth is, but you better know and figure it out by the time you get to 12 step, because that's what you need to be dealing with when you're going to 12 step somebody. In my sobriety, the people that I see that get picked off, long-term sobriety-wise, are people that have more than one problem. They're alcoholic and something else. I just lost a friend of mine a couple weeks ago. He's alcoholic and he's got a pill problem. Long-term sobriety, he's 12-stepping people, he's sponsoring people, he's doing the deal over here for his alcoholism, didn't deal with his drug problem. He hadn't 12-stepped anybody in years with pills. And next thing you know, he's writing himself a little prescription here, a little fake prescription, and he's snorting some pills, and he's wondering why all of a sudden after long-term sobriety he's not sober anymore. And he's having a hard time getting back. He had two truths and was only dealing with half. I call it hiding out in AA. He's coming to AA meetings, 12-stepping over here, dealing with this half of his addiction, and the cobra came up over here and nailed him in the back of the head. And he didn't know where did it come from. If you're dually addicted, if you've got more than one problem, you got to 12-step in those areas. You know, it's part of keeping your memory green. It does not work to keep your memory green by telling your story at the podium. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about taking somebody through the steps and he still smells like piss. He smells like puke. You can see the pain in his eyes. And those memories, your memory comes right back and it slaps you with that hopelessness. And man, you know that you are whatever your truth is. That's why we have to carry this message to others. That's where our long-term sobriety protection comes from. Whatever that truth is, deal with it when we get to step 12. The purpose of going through the steps is to figure it out. I used to think I was an alcoholic and all kinds of different things. My truth has changed. I realized when I wanted to quit smoking marijuana, I decided, hey, I'm done smoking marijuana. I put it down. I was smoking an ounce a day. Just put it down on my own power. No 12 steps. That told me I wasn't powerless over marijuana. Same thing with amphetamines. I stayed up 3 days one time. I felt so bad, I swore I'd never do it again, and I never took another amphetamine other than caffeine, you know. I'm not powerless over amphetamines. You know, my truth has changed the longer I've been sober by repeatedly looking at this stuff. I know what my truth is, and what my truth is, I 12-step in those areas because I don't want those things. I'm powerless over those things. If I don't keep that memory green, it'll come back and bite me, and I don't want that. I don't think God wants that, you know. So I'll get off my soapbox and get it over to Chris. He's going to talk about some of the doctor's opinion from starting with page one.
Thanks, Peter. One of the things that nearly killed me when I was first coming around to Alcoholics Anonymous was comparing and not identifying. A lot of people come in to AA and they think that they're not that bad. They're not as bad as the other people around. I was the reverse of that. I came in and I didn't see anybody I thought that was anywhere near as bad of a drinker and a user as I was. And that they're, both of those aspects are ego. But I almost compared myself out of AA. I just saw too many happy people, and I had gone so far down the scale, and I was comparing my drama with their lives. I had an incredible amount of drama going on in my life, an incredible amount of crazy situations and unmanageability. And I didn't see it in the people in AA, so I thought I was in the wrong place. Maybe I should have gone to a different meeting where everybody's miserable. I would have been able to identify. But that wasn't the case. When going through Bill's story today, what I try to do is I try to identify some of the things that are true about my relationship with alcohol also. Because we can all have different drama. The person who had one or two cocktails too many at the Christmas party and embarrassed themselves versus the person who committed homicides when they were drinking. The difference is in the drama. They can have the same relationship with alcohol. They can both be as alcoholic as the other person. You know what I mean? It's all in the relationship with alcohol. And I'm going to just point out some of the things that I identify with Bill's relationship with alcohol. He said, page one, bottom of the first paragraph, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. I drank to get rid of the loneliness that I was suffering. I lost everybody that cared about me because of my drinking, so I was lonely. So I would drink because I was very lonely. I do not identify with being a First World War veteran, you know, but that really doesn't matter. I'm looking at my relationship with alcohol. Top of page two. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investor for a surety company. He got this close to a law degree and then went and worked on Wall Street as something different. I relate a lot to that too, because has anybody in here ever been a real good starter? You know, I mean, you started things well. I mean, you really went in there 100%, and somewhere along the line, it kind of petered out. I mean, that was part of my unmanageability of life. I went to college for 6 years. I don't even have an associate's degree. You know what I mean? I took things like appreciating music and swimming, and I would drop the things like statistics 3 and business law because they cut into my time too much. You know? So I have this lopsided college degree. Down a little bit, he's talking about his relationship with his wife. He would have long talks with her when he would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, and that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thought were so derived. What a pile of crap. But I'm telling you, I use that one. You know what I mean? I use that. Honey, I have a dark, complex, artistic personality. That's, you know, I feel reality too sharply. I have to have a few drinks. Don't you understand? You know, and that was me. I would still her forebodings until the couches went flying later in the night. You know, but, by the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. You know, unbelievable. Next page, paragraph one. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. Absolutely. Drink was taking the most important part of my life. I look back on my drinking history, and I look at it like I had to throw things in the basket to pay for my drinking. I had to throw jobs in the basket to pay for my drinking. I had to throw relationships in the basket. I had to throw my driver's license in the basket to pay for my drinking. I had to throw my family in the basket to pay for drinking. It was costing me a lot. So was it an important relationship? Was it an important aspect of my life? It sure was. Paragraph two. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. I lost all of my friends because my drinking just escalated above theirs. I truly was hanging around heavy drinkers only, but even among the heavy drinkers, they got to a point where they just wouldn't deal with me anymore because I just went into such insanity when I drank. And it was also, I identify with the progression. The progression was there with Bill as it was there with me. Bottom of page three, I began to be jittery in the morning. This is the beginnings of alcohol detoxification, and that was happening with me. I shook like a maniac in the morning. The straw that broke the camel's back in my alcoholism, where I sought help, was I became an electrician somehow in my drinking. I woke up one day and I was an electrician. It wasn't really something that I had planned. And I wasn't even a good electrician, as you can imagine. You know, I did some crazy things. But I was working for this contractor. I was 32 years old, and a 19-year-old kid was in charge of the crew. I mean, that's how much faith my boss had in me. But the thing that really got my attention was I was putting a screw in a ceiling fixture, and I couldn't hold the screw on the end of the screwdriver and get it into the fixture. I was shaking too much. And I looked down, and this 19-year-old foreman that I had was looking at me with this look of like, you pathetic, you disgusting pathetic. I knew he was thinking that because if you're an alcoholic, you can hear people thinking at you. So I knew he was thinking at me, and I hate that, by the way, when people thinking at me. But I got to the point where I said enough, and the next day I signed myself into treatment, and you know, I was jittery. Page four, paragraph two. Drinking caught up with me again, and I had to be let go, and I went to live with my wife's parents. Any good alcoholic worth their weight in salt moves home to mom, you know, and that happened to me. I'd been living in Florida for 5 years on my own, and I'd lost my family, my job. I had no money in the bank, all my scorecards read zero. I thought to myself, you know, mom hasn't seen me in a while. I bet I could really help her out around the house. So I moved back home for about 6 years before I was still like still making amends for that. Anyway, my wife began to work in a department store. And here he is drinking at home. Same thing, that's why I lost my family. My wife finally became 9 months pregnant, and I had to go out and get a job, and I had to resent it, you know, because she couldn't work anymore. She was very unreasonable. Page five, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I absolutely had to have alcohol. I had to have alcohol just to be able to survive. I would shake myself to pieces. I would suffer from the highest of forms of anxiety if I didn't have booze. Down a little bit. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. For me, it was just vodka. Nevertheless, I still felt I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my life's hope. He's really going through some serious progression here. He woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. Okay? The first drink gets him drunk. He's got that. Okay? The first drink gets me drunk. I understand that. Well, what happens? Certainly that self-knowledge is not enough to solve the problem, because shortly afterward, he came home drunk again. Over on page 6. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone, and in no time I was beating the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. This is another perfect example of the obsession of the mind, and I want to use one of my personal experiences to describe this. After my fiasco with the screw in the fixture box, and I went to CAI rehab, I was in outpatient, and I was going to AA meetings. But there were a lot of suggestions that I, you know, because of my own dark, complicated, artistic personality, didn't feel like I really needed to follow, like getting a sponsor and things like that. So I didn't do any of that. So you have to understand me. I hated authority. I hated being locked up. I hated being in crowds, and I hated people telling me what to do. So if it was so bad that I would sign myself into a rehab, pay for outpatient $70 a week, and go to AA meetings, those A&A meetings with all those losers down in the basement, I had a desire not to drink. I had a serious desire not to drink. I had an incredible serious desire not to drink, if you knew me at all at that time. Let me tell you what happened. One day I was driving to an AA meeting, and the thought occurred to me that I hadn't really been trying very hard in AA. And I think it's because I don't really remember what it's like to be drunk. I mean, it's been months since I've been drunk. And you know what? I'll bet you if I bought a gallon of vodka and I drank it, it would make me feel so bad that I would remember what it's like to be drunk, and I would rush back to AA, and I'd be a super AA. So I bought a gallon of vodka and I started drinking it. Let me tell you what happened. After about the second drink, when you start to get that euphoric glow, you know, the second drink euphoria with vodka, I started pounding the table and I said to myself, what the hell have I done? I just woke up the beast. Because I knew right then the enormity of my mistake. Now I'm going to be carried on to whatever bitter end it was going to take me. I am in trouble now. Let me ask you a question. Was I insane after I was drinking, or was I insane before I was drinking? You're right. The booze restored me to sanity. It showed me what I had done. But by then it was too late because the phenomenon of craving grabbed me. You know what I mean? It's an awful cycle. It's an awful cycle, and it has to be broken. It has to be broken with spiritual experience. Down at the bottom. Then the night came when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leak. He was living in a brownstone, like a four or five story brownstone. He was afraid he was going to jump through the window, so he grabbed his mattress and he was heading down the hall. Can you imagine his neighbors? You know, Bill, where are you going with your mattress? Oh, I'm going to jump. I'm going to jump. So I want it to be from the first floor. Okay. Alcohol's getting the poor guy. Doctor bought a heavy sedative. What did he do? He started drinking on the sedative. Has anyone ever in here ever drank on their sedatives? Raise your hand. You know, any good alcoholic worth their weight in salt. He says, I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Then he goes in for the so-called belladonna treatment, hydrotherapy and mild exercise. Belladonna is a poison hydrotherapy. They put you on a gurney and shove you in a shower stall and hit you with hot and cold water. Not the rehab I want to go to if I ever relapse. Thank you. And steer me away from there.
There's an interesting quote from Pass It On page 101. It says, alcoholics were purged and puked. The purging was most probably the effect of liberal doses of castor oil that the patients were given together with belladonna, a barbiturate to sedate them, and the belladonna was for reducing the stomach acids. So they're shoving so much castor oil in you that your stomach's going crazy with acid, so they got to mix a little poison in there to calm the acid down, and they shove you in the shower and start nailing you with hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold.
The rehab food took care of my purging problem. paragraph 3 on page 7. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank much more. Oh, after the belladonna treatment, the shower stall treatment, I mean, this guy really seriously has a desire to stop drinking, but the day came, and he drank again. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. Absolutely incredible. And this will bring us to the end of the first part of Bill's story.
There's one more thing on 8:2, second sentence. It says, then came the insidious insanity of the first drink. I went and looked up the definition for insidious. It says, ambush, lying in wait to ensnare, or intended to entrap, characterized by treachery and deceit. You know, this is not a fun disease we have. It's lying in wait to nail us. if we jump ahead to page, let's see, page 11. 11:3, it says, but my friend sat before me. He had made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. This is when Ebby comes to him, and it's his high school chum. He comes there and says, hey, Bill, I got religion. And Bill's like, whoa, what are you talking about? You know, and he's drinking, he's thinking he's going to have a party with this guy. And he says, no, I don't want to drink. And so Ebby's just sitting there 12-stepping Bill, and Bill's sitting there drinking gin, wondering what the hell happened. It says the declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. But like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. That's one of the critical things for an alcoholic. We have to admit that we're defeated. And then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. You know, from Passing On page 386, it says, this spiritual experience had been our key to survival and growth. We saw that the alcoholic's helplessness could be turned to vital advantage. By the admission of this, he could be deflated at depth. Thus, the fulfilling of the first condition was a remotivating conversion experience. Dr. Silkworth's expression describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus allergy, by now we knew from experience that the new prospect had to accept step one or get no place. And then in AA Comes of Age on page 74, it says, drinkers would not take pressure in any form except from John Barleycorn himself. You know, you can't tell an alcoholic. It's one of the reasons that rehabs don't work. You can't tell an alcoholic how to be sober. The only thing we listen to is the beating that we get administered under the lash of alcoholism. And even when the beating stops, we come into sobriety, it's insidious. It's just waiting to strike. You know, it never leaves us. 12:4. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. As far as the willing to believe, there's something called a God experiment that they talk about in AA Comes of Age. And it says, I know you're going to gag on this. He's quoting from Ebby in the history book. And this is Ebby talking. He says, Bill, I know you're going to gag on this, but they taught me that I should try to pray to whatever God I thought there was for the power to carry out these precepts. And if I did not believe that there was a God, I had better try the experiment of praying to whatever God there might be. So I don't care what your conception of God is. When I'm working with a newcomer and he's atheistic or agnostic, that's okay. That is his conception of God. That's good enough to start for step one. You know, it's a hard thing. When you start doing a lot of 12-step work, you'll run into that. You know, and whatever their conception is, you say, you know what, that's okay. We'll go from there. All the power has to be is greater than them. We don't care what your belief is, as long as it's not you. You cannot be God. That's the only restriction we have in AA. The other thing that I read was, you notice it said, upon a foundation of complete willingness. Why do I emphasize this? This is what I call the construction references. You know, And if on page 2 of the guide I handed out, they're all listed there for you. The reason I make emphasis to this, remember, I'm the checklist guy, right? You know, he's the funny guy. I'm the step guy, you know. The construction references become important when we get to the fifth step. Because after the fifth step, we're given an instruction to go home for an hour. And we're supposed to look at certain things. And one of the questions that Bill tells us is, he says, are your stones properly in place? Well, what the hell does that mean? If somebody hasn't bothered to show you what the hell the stones are, you're not going to know. And Bill uses a metaphor. Just like the Bible always uses metaphors, he builds a spiritual arch through which we're going to pass to new freedom. And the foundation of our arch is going to be complete willingness. Remember last night we talked about honesty, the honest desire? We're going to see that again. There's certain things that are going to be part of step one, and this is going to be part of one of the pieces of step one. We have to have a foundation of complete willingness. It says it again in how it works. Willing to go to any length. What are they talking about? Willingness. We need a foundation of complete willingness. So the construction references are listed in the guide. Then Bill goes off on page 13 about what he did to get sober. He talks about all the steps that he did in the hospital. At the bottom, 13.5. It says, my friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator and that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. What a promise that is. A way of living that will answer all your problems. Talk about a promise. I want that. All right? Now look at this. Belief in the power of God. Notice it doesn't say you have to believe in God. You have to believe in the power of God. And remember what I said earlier. Anytime we're talking about God, we're talking about your conception. It's your higher power. So whatever that is, why did I come to AA? I would not have come to AA if I didn't believe AA had something that could get me out of the gutter and into sobriety. They had something that I wanted. They had a way to stop drinking, and I didn't. That was my conception of a higher power when I came in, you know, and that was enough to begin. So it's one of the requirements for step one is you got to believe that AA has something for you, or why bother come to AA? You know, if you don't believe we can do something for you, there's no sense in being here, right? So belief in the power of God plus willingness, there it is again, it's the second time we've seen willingness, honesty, there's number 3, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Have you ever heard that step one has requirements? Well, there's 6 of them. So far, we've gotten 4. There's 2 more that are going to come later on. And those are also listed in the guide under the step one requirements with the page references for it. 14:6. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works is dead, he said, and how appalling and true for the alcoholic. For if the alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge the spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, so much for a selfish program, right? He could not survive a certain trials and lust thoughts ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die, and faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Definitions. Absolute, free from limit, restriction, or qualification, or exception. In other words, there's no exception to alcoholics. The absolute necessity, inevitable, that which makes an act or event unavoidable. Compulsion, fate, requisite, a requirement. So here are requirements for us to be sober. One of the things we're going to have to do is work with others. It's imperative, expressing a command or a plea. Directive, you know, they're pleading with us to go out and work with others. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands again, but think to yourself, how long have I been sober? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? When was the last time you 12-stepped somebody? Here's our founder saying it. Your life depends on it. It's absolutely imperative for your recovery to go out and do work and self-sacrifice and carry this message to others. And if it's been a year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, I suggest maybe it's time to go back and start helping somebody. What are you forgetting? What are you missing? Why did Bill make the statement? And they make it over and over and over again. page 16, last page of Bill's story. 16:2. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all, and I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is a deadly... The program says we have to have faith 24 hours at a time, you know? We don't quit drinking one day at a time. We quit forever. In Bill's story on page 5, he says, I was through drinking forever. On page 34, it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. On page 44, it says, if when you want to, you can't quit entirely. On page 142, it says, we will take every necessary step steps, submit to anything to get well, to stop drinking forever. If you look at Dr. Bob's story, he says, if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and for all. It's one of the cliches and half-truths that we hear in meetings. Oh, I just don't drink one day at a time. No. We quit drinking. Our intention is not to ever take another drop of alcohol. We miss the point. The point is we have to have faith. We have to have our sobriety relies on that relationship of faith with a higher power. That's what AA is all about. It's critically important to our long-term sobriety. Let's see, where are we? Let's go over page 17. 17:2, halfway down through the paragraph. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from a shipwreck, when camaraderie and joyousness and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Why did he make this reference? Because in the 1930s, air travel wasn't real big. The major ways of traveling were train and by boat. And to make sensational news, usually were shipwrecks. You had the Titanic in, what was it, 1912 and Lusitania. And anytime there's a big shipwreck, it made the news. So it's logical that he would make reference to a big news story. And he talks about the analogy of a shipwreck. Right? Unlike the feelings of the shipwreck passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go individual ways. The feeling that we have shared in a common peril is one of the elements in the powerful cement which binds us. Well, if that's only one element, there must be another element. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Why am I emphasizing this? This is another construction reference. When we get to the quiet hour after the fifth step, one of the things it says, how is our cement? Have we tried to mix mortar without sand? We're making reference back to this. Are we only dealing in the problem? You know, you hear it at meetings when you hear somebody get up at the mic in a speaker's meeting. You know, drunk-a-log. Then it came to AA, everything's great, and you sit down. All you heard was problem, and then they go, that's the end of it. They're only in half the cement. That isn't going to bind them to AA. What binds us is, yeah, I got the problem. I can identify with the problem, but I also have a solution. It's got to be a balance. We can't be living all in the problem. We have to be living in the solution to mix it together for the powerful cement which will bind us. Jump to the next page. 18:1. An illness of the sort, we have become to believe it an illness, involves those about us which no way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. Look at this. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. When it comes time to make your 8-step list, the people that say, well, I never really hurt anybody except myself. Wait a minute. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. That's a pretty good indication that there's other people you hurt, not just yourself. It brings misunderstanding, fish resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped and blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. 18:4. But the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, that's a requirement. In other words, you got to have the solution, who's properly armed with fact about himself, hopefully you've done some 4-step and 5-step work, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's going to become important when we start talking about 12-step work. You better have a solution. You have something to carry to the guy. Or why waste your time talking to him if you don't have a solution for him? 19:1. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, but a much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. 19:3, second sentence. We shall bring to task our combined experience and knowledge. Remember what I said last night? Anytime the big book talks about knowledge, they always talk about experience first. Experience. Knowledge isn't any good to you. Go out and have your own experience. Compare what this book is saying with your own drinking history. How does this stuff work for you? Does your experience back up what is true in this book? And this should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with our drinking. That's why they're talking about experience. If your experience is the same as Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, then this is a useful program for you. If your experience when you were drinking, if you didn't have the physical craving, maybe you're not alcoholic. If you didn't have a mental obsession, maybe you're not alcoholic. Maybe you've got some other problem. Doesn't mean the 12 steps won't work for you, but it's part of finding out your truth. It's part of the mental obsession. We need to start looking at this stuff. Top of 20:0. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. But wait a minute, I thought it's a selfish program. You know, you're going to get sick of hearing me say that. This book over and over and over and over again says it's not about being selfish. It's about helping the other person. What are they talking about when they say it's a selfish program? What they're saying is we can't do anything unless we're sober. That's as far as our selfishness should stop right there. Get sober and then go out and help somebody else, because it's in the helping somebody else that ensures your sobriety. You know, and we alcoholics, at least I should speak for myself, me as an alcoholic, I want to take care of me. That's been my problem my entire life. I'm much too concerned about me. I should be more concerned about helping somebody else, and God will take care of me. It'll all straighten out in the works. Then they go through and they give us some descriptions of alcoholics, of drinkers. They talk about the moderate drinker. They talk about the hard drinker. And it's kind of interesting with the hard drinker. On the bottom of page 26, Christian, 20:6, the last two sentences, it says, then there's a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit, what an interesting word for Bill Wilson to choose, the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. Look at this. It may even cause him to die a few years ahead of his time. I've seen people in AA all the time that say, well, I was killing myself with drinking. I must be alcoholic. No, you may be and you're not. If you don't have the craving and the mental obsession and spiritual malady, keep on reading. Says it may cause him to die a few years before his time, but if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or warning of a doctor, becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate. What's the difference? An alcoholic can't stop. He's powerless. There's no sufficient reason in the world for him to stop drinking. That's why he needs a power greater than himself. And then he talks about the real alcoholic on 20:1. About the third sentence down, it says, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. We're talking about the physical craving again. Bottom of 22:4. We know that while an alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he will react much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatever into his system, something happens both in the body and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. Look at this. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. We're at the top of page 23. From this point forward, pretty much the book does not mention craving again. This whole time they've been talking about, basically, physical craving. What happens to us when we drink? So here's your question for you. Does your experience, your drinking experience, put it in your own terms, abundantly confirm that something happens to you once you start drinking? You have a physical craving. When you're drinking number one, you're thinking about number two. When you're drinking number two, you're thinking about, geez, I'm out of money. Where am I going to get my next six-pack? What am I going to get a drink in the morning when I'm hungover? Our craving takes us. That's one of the things for an alcoholic. And if you believe our medical expert, Dr. Soapworth, it is limited to this class and never affects any other class. Alcoholics get this craving, the alcoholic type of craving. Yeah, there's other drugs that cause craving. Their craving's a little bit different than our craving, and we can talk about that on a break if anybody's interested, but the alcoholic craving is kind of unique. Once we're taking it, we want more. For example, heroin, once they take it, they don't want any more. They call it getting well. You spike, you're well. The craving goes away until you start to withdraw, and then you want more. It's when they don't have the drug that their craving gets them. Our craving gets us when we have the drug, we want more and more and more. That would kill a heroin addict. They'd OD every time, you know? So there are differences. Drug is not a drug is not a drug. Anyway. So that's the end of the craving, and why don't you take start off with the mental obsession.
Okay. All right.
I got screwed up.
That's all right.
You're on your own.
All right, we've been talking mainly about the craving. There's a lot of overlapping in the book. You can't really say that it was just about the craving, because they talk a lot about the mental obsession and the unmanageability too. But in general, that's true. And if you want to start to look at the mental obsession, we're going to start to look at it now. The observations that we just looked at would be academic and pointless if we never took the first drink, setting aside setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. You know, again, we've asked this question already. Why do we pick up the first drink? What's with us? And if you ask us, we'll probably come up with some reasons, like she left, or I got fired, you know, whatever reasons you're going to come up with. they sound valid to non-drinkers or whoever, you know what I mean? But they really make little sense compared to the complete catastrophe that drinking causes in our lives. You know what I mean? They relate it to hitting yourself on the head with a hammer so you don't feel the pain. And that's a very, very good one. Over on page 24, paragraph 1. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. Well, there goes keeping my memory green, huh? You know what I mean? We can throw that one out. That one may work 9 times out of 10. But what about the 10th time?
Do you notice the word they used? The second sentence on that, 24:1, it says, we have lost the power of choice in drink. Remember I said we're going to start pulling apart sentences? Why didn't he say to drink or about drinking? I went back and I dug out the word in. I thought it was ridiculous. I said, let me go take a look at it. It says in, with respect to indicating inclusion, encompassment, or engrossment to the scope, influence, or character state of condition. In other words, he means the scope of drinking. It means not just to drink before we pick up the drink. It means during the drinking and after we put the drink down. He's talking about we have lost the power of choice in every area when it comes to drinking. Now, how can we say we have a choice whether we drink or not? Today, I just choose not to drink. He's just got done telling us we have lost the power of choice to drink. If we pick up the drink, the physical craving gets us. If we put the drink down, the mental obsession will get us. And if we're sober long enough, we don't have the mental obsession, eventually the spiritual malady will get us because alcoholism is insidious. You know? And look on 24:0, three sentences, or second sentence down. It says, the most powerful desire to stop drinking was absolutely of no avail. But wait a minute. The only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking, but they're just telling us that that is of no good to us. It's of no avail. That tells me all that does is get you a seat in AA. The desire to stop drinking is the admission card to walk through that door. It has nothing to do with whether you're going to stay sober or not. As Chris said last night, we haven't drank in years. We have no longer the desire to stop drinking because we're not drinking. Does that mean we're disqualified from AA? Uh-uh. You know, it must mean there's something else holding us here in this program other than this desire to stop drinking.
Yeah. So when this thinking pattern, when our powerlessness in drink has manifested itself to a certain degree, when this sort of thinking is fully established, an individual with alcoholic tendencies has probably placed himself beyond human aid and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. Not the best of news for us. For a number of reasons. One of them is Alcoholics Anonymous is human aid. There's a bunch of human people in here. And if I go to my AA meetings to stay sober, that's a lot of human aid. Getting locked up, dying, or going permanently insane are not really great things either. So we're really between a rock and a hard place here. There is a solution on page 25, paragraph 1. Almost none of us like the self-searching, fifth step, the leveling of our pride, fifth step, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for successful consummation, that's the fifth step. But we saw it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. When someone comes up to you and they can ID with you completely about your drinking and your alcoholism and the problem has been removed in them and they're recovered people, it will get your attention. It will get your attention. There's enough of them around to carry the message to you.
Look at the title of this chapter. There is a solution. And the title of that little paragraph you just read, 25:1, there is a solution. That tells me, let's look after the solution. What did they just tell us? We're going to need to be self-searching, fourth step, right? We're going to need to level our pride. That's just leveling of your pride, step one, to come in through the doors. You have to level your pride in order to walk through the door. Fifth step, to go ask somebody and tell somebody that. If you've ever done a fifth step, you know that it means leveling your pride. And if you've gone and made amends, you know a ninth step, that will definitely level your pride. Confession of shortcomings, that's a fifth step. you know, and pick up the kit of spiritual tools. What are they? Everything else. 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 11, 10, 11, and 12. You know? And what do you get from it? The last sentence there. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Compare that to your current sobriety. Do you feel like you're in the fourth dimension of existence? Do you feel like life is better than it ever has been and it could ever get any better than this? That life, you're happy, joyous, and free, and the promises are true? Or are you waking up every morning like somebody pissed in your Wheaties? You know? You're moody, you're temperamental. Does anybody ever look at you and say, what's wrong with you today? You know? How does that compare with the fourth dimension of existence? Maybe we missed something along the line.
The great fact is this and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. This is what can happen when you recover. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He's commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And that's a big paragraph toward what the solution is. If you're as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. A lot of middle-of-the-road solutions exist in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And one of my theories is that there's a lot of hard drinkers in Alcoholics Anonymous today. There are a lot of hard drinkers who still have control over whether they pick up a drink or not. You can usually ID them. They've never done any steps, they've never done any service, they go to one meeting a week and they're fine. You know what I mean? If I tried that, I'd be on suicide watch, you know? So there's a lot of middle-of-the-road solutions. Just don't drink and go to meetings. That's a middle-of-the-road solution.
Basically, any message that doesn't have depth and weight. Remember what the doctor said? Our message has to have depth and weight. Don't drink and go to meetings. To me, there's no depth and weight in that, you know? I need spiritual steps. I need work with that. You know, you can take what you want and leave the rest. I've heard that a lot. It doesn't hold a whole lot of depth and weight. You know, work one step a year. I'd be dead if I tried to work one step a year. You know, long ago, that kind of stuff. But that doesn't have depth and weight. You know, those are middle-of-the-road solutions.
And there's a lot of them today out there, and you really have to watch it, especially if you happen to be what is termed a real alcoholic. You better beware of those.
Here's another one. Meeting makers make it. Have you ever seen somebody that goes to meetings regularly and goes out and drinks? You know? Compare these things. When you hear these little cliches get thrown around AA and everybody listens to them, we hear them, compare it to your experience. I see meeting makers not make it. What am I not doing right? What's the difference between them and me? I tell you, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And that's one of the tests I use.
One of the questions that we gave everyone last night was, do you believe that you only have two ways to go? Remember that, door A and door B. Live along spiritual lines or die an alcoholic death. It says here that we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other was to accept spiritual help. This isn't an easy alternative to face. I'll tell you what. I had lost my family, I'd lost 13 jobs, I'd lost my driver's license, I'd lost the respect of anybody I cared about. But the very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting I ever went to, I talked a friend of mine into taking me because alcohol was really starting to get my attention. This was about in the mid-80s sometime. And I said, Danny, take me to one of those A&A meetings. I got to do something about my drinking. And I walked in there. I had to get a little drunk because I didn't do well with crowds. So I got a little buzz on. I went up to the A&A meeting at the top of my street, and I walked in there, and it was kind of okay, but it was one of those meetings where they talked about issues. There was something that went around the North Jersey AA in the 80s, and I was talking about feelings and issues, and I was an alcoholic that was dying of alcohol, and I didn't relate to a word that was said in that meeting. It wasn't really bad, but I didn't relate to a word that was said in that meeting. But all of a sudden, I realize I'm in a church basement. They're passing around a basket, okay? And at the end, everybody gets up, they stand up, and they grab my hand, and they start to say the Lord's Prayer. So I'm thinking to myself, oh, no, I'm with the rollers now. You know what I mean? And I had unreasonable prejudice toward religious institutions. I was watching the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and the Jimmy Swaggart stuff on TV, you know. I knew what those people were all about. So it was not an easy alternative for me to face, to accept spiritual help. So I didn't. And I went out and I drank for 5 more years until I was willing to come in and hold your hand and put money in your basket and say the Lord's Prayer. I finally came back in willing. So I know what they mean. It's not always an easy alternative to face.
Take a break and we'll come
back. Okay. We're going to take a break.
Let's take a quick break, you know. Quick cigarette break, 5 minutes. Let's come back.